sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A better but mixed week for markets. June rate hike is definitely in the cards and on the table. Frank Curzio is our guest today. We're going to spend some time with him talking about all sorts of areas of market economics and a whole bunch of other things. All this and much more on episode number 464 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, welcome and thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. Comes each and every week talking about all sorts of things related to markets, money, and your investments. And this week's going to be a great episode with Frank Curzio. We're going to really cut down the beginning introductory portion of this particular show and really get to our guest in just one second. I want to talk about very quickly some of the things that went on over the last week and some of the things that we have to look forward to in the week ahead. Clearly, the biggest issue was whether or not the Fed is going to really do something about a rate hike at their June meeting, which now is quote unquote live. At least that's what we hear from many of the Fed participants as they've been parading around talking this up. And what we saw in the minutes from the last monthly meeting, the confab of the Fed, we did see that the CPI, the inflation rate, did tick up to about 0.4%, which is one of the biggest gains we've seen since February 2013. A lot of it was because we saw about a 10% jump in gasoline prices. Of course, we saw that oil was moving higher over the last month or so. And that is possibly going to add to the idea that the Fed may, in fact, be reaching their target numbers with their dual mandate, which, of course, is inflation and employment. So markets kind of got a little bit taken back by that. There was some concern that, wow, really, we thought this was not going to happen in front of the November political events that will be happening with the presidential election and campaigning and the fact that the economies around the world have still not really healed very well. Well, what's going to happen now? Well, after this recent minutes were released, it does seem like there is a higher probability, not an absolute, but a higher probability of a rate hike coming potentially in June. Even though while the inflation rate was higher on a month over month, still over year, it's probably close to about 2%. We saw some gains in existing home sales that were good. 1.7% increase in home buying in April, 6% year over year gain, which was good. The median sales price last month for homes was $232,000, which was an increase of about 6.5% from a year ago. And there's also a drop in inventory, so housing is still doing pretty well. Permits, industrial output were also on the rise. We saw that some of the numbers economic-wise were pretty good last week, considering that there was a concern just a few months ago that things were just falling off a cliff and we were going to have a recession and all sorts of things. And we're still seeing some earnings drop that's been very concerning, particularly for the retail sector last week again. And it was, at the end of the week, a mixed return for indices. The NASDAQ and the S&P were higher, NASDAQ by about 1%, the S&P by about 0.28, and the Dow was down about 0.2%. Now, coming up this week, we have a little bit lighter economic calendar, and economics obviously are very important, but earnings are going to be coming out as well. We're at the tail end of the earnings season. Big Lots is going to be reporting on Monday. On Tuesday, we got the Census Bureau coming out with new home sales report. And then we have earnings from AutoZone, Best Buy, Hewlett Packard Industries, Intuit, Toll Brothers, and Valspar. Now, Wednesday, we're going to have Costco, Express, Guess, Popeyes, Tiffany's. We're going to have the pending home sales index and a report on durable goods on Thursday. And we're going to be seeing earnings from Abercrombie & Fitch, Burlington Stores, Chico's, Dollar General, GameStop, Sears. And then on Friday, we'll see the University of Michigan's final May Consumer Sentiment Index and the Fed's second estimate of quarter one growth of GDP. So we're going to see some things that are of importance. I think the biggest issue we've been seeing recently has been the very, very mixed numbers from retail. A couple of companies did very well last week, but generally speaking, when it comes to the big box and even the discounters have not been doing well. Walmart clearly blew it out last week. On the other hand, Target really missed very wildly. It was a pretty ugly move for Target, one of the worst moves they've had in years post-earnings, while Walmart had its best move that we've seen post-earnings in years. And Urban Outfitters did well, and American Eagle Outfitters did well. But we did see that Gap was middle of the road, questionable, and probably some of the store sales, cost-cutting that they did helped them out a lot. But still, sales have not been great. So a very mixed bag when it comes to retail these days. And it's going to be interesting to watch why that is, and I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about, well, is it a change in consumer habits? Is it a that is just changing the way they shop? Or is it the fact that they're not shopping? That's the things that we have to look at right now. Anyway, as I mentioned, we're going to have a great guest today, Frank Curzio, and I want to get right to him and discuss some of the things that he has on his mind, plus a follow-up on some of the things that we talked about over the last, 12 months, and kind of see how those played out. So let's get right down to it. And our guest today for an elongated session, because you love him, you know him, you got to have him, you got to be with him, you love what he says and what he's got to give. It's Frank Curzio. Yes, your friend of mine, the host of Wall Street Unplugged, one of the best, if not the best, of course, this one excluded, podcast in the world on finance, where you find out all the things you need to know about finance and just the straight information. So, Frank, let me be first, by the way, wish you, I know a couple of days ago you had a birthday. Happy birthday, buddy.
Thank you very much.
So what are you now, like 32?
21.
Yeah.
After 40, you just forget. So it doesn't matter anymore, right?
Yeah. We got a lot of topics to talk about. You and I talk all the time. We talk during the week. We kind of text back and forth. Yeah. And we got to start sending some creepy Snapchat pictures to each other, too. That'll be fun. My son just added Snapchat chat to my phone. It's stupid as can be, mm-hmm. but there's some funny things and some great technology they use for facial recognition.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I was actually looking at it the other day. Great social media platform. It's pretty cool. So many kids on it, though, right?
Every kid. That's all they do is the Snapchat thing, the stories and all that. Anyway, let's talk about some of the things that are going on with the market, some of the things that are going on. And what I did, I didn't tell you about this necessarily. What I did is I went back to several of our last times that we talked in the podcast that we had, and I wanted to see, okay, how good is Frank?
Uh-oh.
Yep. How bad is Frank? What's going on? What did he do? What did he say?
Isn't scripted, guys. Yep. This is new. So this could be very bad or it should be pretty good, though, I think.
Let's see. Let's go back to March 8th of 2015. Back then, you were like, sell Apple. That was episode number 403. Yeah. You were giving me all these reasons back then, about a year ago or so. And you were saying that, Apple has peaked out and, iPhone sales are slowing. You gave a whole bunch of reasons why. And at the time, by the way, I also went back and looked at the stock price.
Yeah.
Stock price back then was 127 mm-hmm. on March 8th, March 9th, and now it's about 93.
Yeah.
So good call. Ding. Good for the... All right, let's talk about the next one.
I got one right.
Yep.
Let's not talk about the next one. Let's just leave it there.
No, the next one was good. Next one was pretty good. Actually, it was a little mixed, but it was pretty good. October 18th, 2015. You are absolute and totally emphatically about selling oil-related and energy companies. Mm-hmm. Chesapeake Energy was one of the ones on your list. You were like, out, get out. Mm-hmm. It was at $8. Now it's about $3.75.
Yeah.
Continental, you were saying their hedges are going to run off. It was about 36. Now it's 40, but it saw 20.
Yeah, it came down tremendously, yeah.
So when oil came back, that was episode number 424. And finally, on December 6th, you said, listen, you got to look at, I took a trip, you said. I was up in all these areas. I was speaking to all the management of all these very smaller junior miner type of gold companies. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the cost of production, and particularly a couple of them in particular were very low cost of production, but $900 an ounce, they can still be profitable. And you said a lot of these things have been obliterated. You said, this could be a life-changing trade. That's what you said.
Mm-hmm.
MUX was the symbol.
Yeah.
It was at 98 cents at the time. Now, $2.74.
Wow.
You didn't even
did
know
I say that?
That? Yes, you did. No. You said this could be a life-changing trade.
Guys, really quick, that story, go on Google, trust me, Rob McEwing, and research that guy. He's the founder of Goldcorp, which is the biggest, you know, producer in the world. And basically with this guy, he hates to take on leverage. And what Goldcorp wanted to do is leverage themselves. So he basically said, all right, I'm done here, and started McEwing Mining. You know, it's like 75% of the company. It's a producer. It was paying a dividend. I mean, they have cash flow, and it's trading at 95 cents, like as if it was a junior. And I met him personally and talked to him for 45 minutes in a one-on-one. What a brilliant, brilliant, innovative person, and a fantastic story, guys. Seriously, you'll read it and you keep reading, and it's one of those things you go on Google, you read for 2 hours, you don't even realize it.
Now, one of the things is, just to kind of give you a summary of this, you know, this is going back about a year, and, mm-hmm. and you know, you talked about generally, listen, you talked about selling Apple, and it was kind of out of form for what markets were thinking at the time back in March. You talk about sell oil. I mean, a lot of people are talking about sell oil, but you went to a conference, you said, and you were in front of people, and you said, absolutely, 90% of the stocks in the energy sector are going to be a problem. You talked about hedges running off. You talked about the fact that bankruptcy is coming. You talked about all these, you know, major problems way ahead of the curve in terms of, I think, what people were seeing there. And as oil was coming down, it came down, and many of the stocks just, I mean, just got obliterated. And then you were talking about, you know, buying the gold miners. So it's both buys and sells here. Now, let's talk about where we are today. Today we are where oil has popped back a bit. Gold has been on an incredible rally, about 18% up for the year to date so far. As the dollar has come down, of course, oil has also come up a bit, kind of dipped and then came back up this year. Do you still see the same things for these three distinct items, selling Apple, selling oil, buying the gold miners, or some of them?
I don't know if I would sell Apple. I think Apple does have more downside here. You just saw that Warren Buffett purchase it. However, that got the headlines. What didn't get the headlines is David Tepper sold his position. I think David Tepper is one of the greatest investors in the world. He was the one in 2011 that went on TV and basically said, you know what's going to go up with all this tightening, and all the easing that the Fed's doing and low interest rates? He goes, everything. Yep. And he was exactly right? Every asset just completely, you know, just art, real estate, stocks, everything just went higher because he knew that they had to put under the market. They were pushing more money into the market, doing everything they can to inflate it. He's out of Apple now. But if you're looking at Apple, and we'll start with that one, the next two quarters are really, really going to be bad. And there's 48 analysts that cover the stock. When I made that call, there was 51 with no sells. Today, there's 45 analysts, and 38 of them have buy ratings, one sell.
Does that mean six of them were fired?
Maybe. I have no idea. Right. Maybe they dropped coverage. They go? I have no idea.
Who's dropping coverage on Apple? They probably said, you can't do this. Just pull it, damn it.
Well, sometimes when they get into the financing and work deals for Apple, they have to drop for a conflict of interest, but whatever it was. But, you know, with Apple, you have to realize, just common sense here. Everyone's going to point to the balance sheet. They're going to point to the cash. Listen, value stocks get cheaper unless they have a growth catalyst. And right now, Apple doesn't have a growth catalyst. You're looking at iPhones. It's an iPhone company. It's 70% of sales. I think it was out of the $15, $20 billion that they generated over the past 12 months, $160 billion from iPhones, right? So now they're in a period where the 7's coming out. So what are you going to do if you want an iPhone? Are you going to buy the 6 or 6S? No, you're probably going to wait. Or if you do buy the 6 or 6S, you're going to get it for a really cheap price. So margins are going to get killed on a product where margins have been historically high. So I don't think that they're going to meet estimates. I don't think they've come down enough, and you may see 85 on that stock.
It's not that far away. But the one thing about Apple, obviously, just to go back to something, because it was a little bit, I think, also, I don't want to say deceiving, but it was confusing. You said this too, that Warren Buffett bought the stock. Yes, I agree that Berkshire Hathaway, which Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, that's interchangeable, did in fact buy $1 billion worth of Apple sometime recently, and probably they're underwater, by the way, on that position. However, it wasn't Warren Buffett. It was the Berkshire Hathaway trading portfolio or the investment portfolio, and the decision was made by one or two or both of the portfolio managers without necessarily getting the seal of approval from Warren Buffett on this. It's not one of these, well, I'm going to buy it and hold it for my rest of my life kind of thing.
Yeah, but usually, Andrew, I think even though it's a portfolio managers, and I'm sure... Yeah, I don't think they have to ask Buffett on any move, but I'm sure that, and maybe they do, but I think they all use the same strategy as looking at deep value plays, buying them, holding long term. Like, I don't know if it's a trading portfolio. I don't know if they're looking to get out of this in a year or two. It's more, for me, it seems like a long-term play, which scares me because that's why Warren Buffett never really invests in technology. Everybody brings up IBM, and I think that trade will work out for him. I think IBM is really doing a good job transitioning their business right now. It's just, you know, it's dirt cheap. Everybody hates it. But anyway, which is usually a buy signal. But for Apple, you have to be careful because technology companies, you can't really buy and hold forever, right? I mean, look how much has changed. Oh, yeah. I mean, the business models have changed. Even Microsoft is like a cloud company now. You know, it's they're giving away Windows for free. You look at, you know, just think of the products in the past. I mean, the VCR, the CD, the DVD, you know, the phone with the cord on it. I mean, it just so rapidly changes where it's difficult sometimes. I mean, you're buying Apple today, they really, you know, you're hoping to get more into Apple TV. The watch, I don't think, again, they sold a lot for every other company out there. It's a good product, but definitely a huge disappointment. But, it's difficult for Apple. I just don't see any growth catalyst.
Well, I mean, one of the things you mentioned about how Buffett buys and whether he's using kind of some type of, you know, old school, I mean, old school isn't bad, but old school dividend discount model or maybe even a Benjamin Graham type of valuation model, which is what they do. But one of the things that seems to be consistent in some of his more recent purchases is the whole idea of companies that are doing buybacks and companies that have stodgy earnings, like kind of not moving very much, and a lot of cash to do so. And I don't know. I mean, it's kind of an interesting way of doing things. And maybe because one of the things that bothers me is, and I keep talking about this over and over again, is the whole idea of these share buybacks. How long does that last? Does it go on forever? I mean, forever and ever and ever. If it doesn't, man, things are not going to be pretty one day because a lot of the stock has been retired by these companies. And, Apple just put out another, I don't even know how much, they're buying back 10% of the company or something like that.
Yeah, and remember, guys, buybacks are not a bad thing, but there's a couple things you need to know where if you're doing it to artificially increase earnings because you're lowering the float's decreasing, it's bad if you're buying it where your stock's near, like Nike. I look at Nike. Nike, I think, is going to be a disaster. I think that stock has at least 20-25% downside here. I mean, they've been manipulating their earnings so much, and they're buying back so much of their stock right now at the highest valuations it's traded in the past 15 years. That's a bad sign. But when you see companies like Hyatt, where the company's down, where it's down tremendously, and just the lodging companies have gotten killed, it's pretty good when you use buybacks. But even the bigger picture, and this is something that Drunken Middle said when Stanley Drunken Middle, when I was at the Iris Owen conference a couple weeks ago, when you're looking at buybacks as a whole, it's not necessarily the best course or the best way to use money, where a lot of the money that's been raised, a lot of debt that these companies have taken, they're using it to buy back stock instead of on CapEx, acquisitions,
R&D,
building business innovation.
Right.
So that's where he's saying where you're borrowing from the future. And, you know, it that can present a huge problem down the road. And I definitely agree. So buybacks might not be the best way to use your money unless your stock is really down and provides good value.
Yeah, I mean, buybacks are, and I mentioned this before a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, buybacks are a quantitative easing for publicly traded companies. They issue bonds, they increase their dividends, and they buy back the stock. I mean, it's from left pocket to right pocket kind of accounting, just to make things look better. And it does something a little bit differently. It doesn't actually lower interest rates for the economy, but it does, in fact, benefit their earnings over time. I'm still not sure why there hasn't been and there is a buyback index out there, I know that. But still, there isn't, how you have EPS and comparable EPS and maybe EBITDA and all these different fundamental ratios that they put out there. Mm-hmm. I'm still surprised that somebody doesn't put out a buyback adjusted EPS for companies.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I tell you what Drunken Miller put up there, which is a cool chart. He just showed how cash flow is being spent, and it showed how much is going towards buybacks and how little is going towards CapEx, and how it basically they're poorly mismanaging their cash. And I think that was important, where you're looking at, okay, you're supposed to be investing in the future, and they're not. They're buying back their stocks. And not only that, if you look at the market index, right, I mean, some stocks have gotten crushed. Walmart last year, now it's up. But some of these guys are just buying back stocks and near their highs because, look, the markets, as bad as everybody says things are, it's still trading well within 4 or 5% of its all-time high.
I think 3% possibly. You know, and Drunken Miller, during his last few different interviews and the one at the Sohn conference just recently, has been pretty darn negative on markets, right?
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, this is one of the first times, because you hear it everywhere, right? The market's going to crash. You hear Schiff been saying it since he was like 40
years
old.
Since he was born.
Yeah, you got all these guys saying markets, you know, even if the market crashed 80%, they'd still be wrong from their original forecasts, which pisses me off. Sorry to say that. But, you know, perma bears or even perma bulls, I'll tell you, they'll destroy your financial means. Listening to these people who, no matter what the facts are, that's why I like David Tepper, where nobody liked what the Fed did. But here's a guy that said, look, nobody likes this, but you got to invest in stocks because it's going to inflate the markets over the next few years. And he was exactly right. But today we're seeing where earnings declining year over year. We're seeing the percentage of operating cash flow in terms of net debt skyrocket. So that's going higher for companies, but yet EBITDA is coming down tremendously. It tells you that the Fed policies, the easy money practices, are no longer working. And when you look at the leverage numbers, they flattened out over the past couple of years, which means companies don't want to take on more debt. They're sick of it. So even if the Fed decides to keep rates low, do whatever they can to stimulate the market, it's not translating into higher earnings.
Well, because what we saw, you and I talked about this a number of months ago, what happened is that while they are at a much lower rate, and one of the things that happens when you have low interest rates initially, especially when they did the QE and Operation Twist and all the other things, it helped companies because they could refinance their current debt, clean up their balance sheets, and it allowed them to have a much lower cost of overall debt. Now what's happened is many companies have issued so much debt that the actual cost of debt is higher than it was in 2005, 2006, 2007. They're paying out a lot more because they have so much more debt on the books, even though they're at lower rates. That's where the problem comes in, because if earnings slow down, they still have to pay out their overall debt payments, right? That's servicing.
Absolutely. But not only is it saying that, bringing up the point before where the Fed stimulus plans they're not working now. Yeah. So they talk about raising rates, actually. But guys, we're in a deflationary environment. If you look at the recent earnings from department stores, I mean, these guys are average 25% declines, the worst same store sales these guys are reporting since the credit crisis. You're looking at Apple, right? Purely a consumer company. Down tremendously, missed earnings estimates. Priceline.com missed earnings estimates. I mean, Walmart came out today, but expectations were so low, you're seeing, what they report is a good number, even though e-commerce came down. So, we've debated this for the last 5 years, and we've probably always been wrong, right? And you never want to doubt the U.S. consumer, but right now,
now here's a question I want to mention. By the way, Walmart came out how could it come out today? It's the weekend, but it came out a few days ago. Nonetheless, I was thinking the markets are open today. How cool is that? So here's the deal. Here's what's interesting. You have a tale of two companies and a tale of different consumerisms. And this is really where the confusion comes in, I think. And I think we should talk about this. So Target comes out, and Target and Walmart are kind of like the same company. It's kind of like Lowe's and Home Depot. Wouldn't you agree?
I wouldn't agree.
You don't
agree?
Only
because Walmart, I mean, if you go in Target, it's definitely more high-end than Walmart. I mean, the clothing's more high-end. Maybe more expensive things you could buy from food. I mean, I think Walmart's more of a lower end.
I'll go with that.
I would say, I don't know.
It's the same concept, but there's different levels of products. So let's look at it that way, right?
Okay, cool.
But Target comes out, and by the way, their stock had not been doing well this year. Not as bad as many of the others, but until they came out, they were down about 7% for the year. They come out with their earnings. The earnings were okay. The revenues were like a bit light, et cetera. Things didn't look so good, but their outlook was just god-awful, right? And stock was down, I think, 9%, one of the biggest declines for Target stock in 15 years after earnings. Walmart comes out a couple days later or a day later, beats earnings. Now, the big question was, they posted their guidance that looked in line and better. So that was really good, and stock was up like 8 or 9%. That could be one of the best moves post-earnings for Walmart. Now, the question is, was it that there was so little expectation for Walmart? Was it something different? Was it the fact that the lower-end pricing for consumers was something that was much more desirable, and that's why we're seeing that the big-box retailers like the Macy's, the Kohl's, the Dillard's, et cetera, are doing just terrible? But then again, JCPenney's not doing good either. I mean, what is it with the consumer? Is it that they're so fickle? Something's wrong.
With the Walmart numbers, too, I think it's an expectation game where I think everyone was really expecting terrible numbers out of Walmart, and they didn't get them, right? I mean, expectations were low because look, everybody that reported before them, right? I mean, you got Kohl's, you got Nordstrom. I mean, horrible. Macy's was horrible. And I think with Target, I don't know if that was really reflected in the price. Well, Walmart got crushed last year, and people were. But I tell you one thing that Walmart's gotten right that I think is fantastic is they raised the minimum wage, right? I mean, their employees aren't getting minimum wage. They're getting well paid much more than that. And guys, that's a huge deal because I live in Florida, and I know people who listen to this in Florida are probably going to make fun of me and never talk to me again. But it's kind of weird down here when it comes to working. I realized coming from New York, people don't like to work here. But when I go on a drive-thru and get McDonald's for my kids now that McDonald's increased their menu to like a million things, it's like 15 minutes for the drive-thru, minimum. And they mess up my order every single time. I went to a pet store recently because I had to get some. I asked the guy. He's like, oh, we don't have it. I said, well, how's this brand? He's like, I don't know. I said, well, how much is it? He's like, I don't know. And I was just going to say, you know, I don't know who's, you know, more of an idiot. You or the guy who hired you. How do you know? I'm asking you simple questions. How don't you know if this is good or not, if this is going to be good for my pet? But with Walmart, I think they're maintaining that employee base because they're getting paid better than anywhere else that they're going to go. And the fact that they're there longer and they're going to know their products and know their stuff, I think that's going to be a huge advantage. And you might be seeing that already, because I could tell you the turnover that's going on in a lot of different industries, in the food industries and even the retail industries, it's kind of crazy. And the people that they're hiring really know nothing about these products. And you know, this is from samples. I have podcasts. I have tens of thousands of people listening. But man, I think that's where they're going to really excel, and you might be seeing it now where, you know, that consumer experience is really, really important, and you're not getting it from a lot of other places right now.
I mean, it's like a Home Depot. You walk in, you find somebody in an orange shirt, and you're like, hey, I need to know about this very rare plumbing issue. Oh, yes, we know what you took. Come over here. I'll show you what to do.
Exactly.
And the guy basically gives you instructions as you're standing there.
And you know, I've been to Lowe's, and I have to go through like 10 aisles.
Oh, yeah, no, I can't. I don't know what people like about Lowe's. I don't understand it.
I'm dead serious. When I go to Home Depot, there's guys coming up to me, hey, what do you need? Can I help you with something? In Lowe's, I can't find a guy that's in the place. I'm like, what?
Hello.
I need this special screw. You know, I got to fix something for my wife, and if I don't fix it in the next hour, I'm in trouble. There's no one I can find. I'm like, right. What's going on? But it's crazy. You know, it is.
Let's talk about retail then in total. So Amazon had a blowout, and who knows how they're moving things from left to right, up and down, not expanding, putting money into this, and then pushing into this quarter. It looks better. But let's talk about the big box retail. I mean, I've had a number of rants, and my people know, and they're sick of me hearing about Macy's and how I just can't take going there, and I can't take going to most of these stores. But then there's some other ones. I mean, for example, in our portfolios, we have American Eagle and Urban Outfitters, and those stocks were getting hurt a bit because of the, you know, the tack on with Gap's problems and the going out of business of a variety of other of the apparel companies, and Aeropostale going out of business, American Apparel going out of business, and they come out with earnings that are just stellar. I mean, just looking great. Stocks are up 15%, 12% on the day right after earnings. But you can't really, it's very odd. The sporting goods companies also, a lot of them going out of business, tons going out of business, consolidating. Is this all a change in consumerism, as in that it's all online, push button, mobile type of app kind of thing? Is it the millennials are changing? And what's going on with retail?
Yeah, I talked to an analyst about this on my podcast last week. And
Christina Benz, right?
Yeah, and she brought up good points. Because she goes everywhere. She goes into these stores. She knows everybody. She talks to them. You know, and usually I can get a good gauge before I look at the numbers by talking to her because she's fantastic. And she was saying, you know, services is big. Travel is huge. The millennials, like the Airbnbs, you know, the Ubers and stuff like that. Services, she was talking about places where she can go and just get her hair blowed out for $40 within services within these stores and you know, they'll give her a glass of wine.
Wait, hold it. To get her hair blown out, it costs $40?
Well, no, it's a whole experience and thing. I think she was saying that people are paying more for experiences now than anything. And that's where the money is, where it's necessary, like if it's travel industry. But she said that's what, because she's right, though. I mean, my wife, too. I mean, the wife that did count for, I forgot what number she said. It was like 75% of spending. But my wife's still spending. It's just a matter of where she's going. You can match prices now very easily. We're not really going to the malls too much. I mean,
the malls are dead. I've been to several different malls, and maybe just local issues, and maybe just, yeah, you know, it may be where I'm going. But I look around every time I get in the mall, I'm looking around. The movies are packed. Some of the restaurants are doing well. And
yeah,
everything else is like, where are the people?
I know. Hello? Even the Macy's and JCPenney's, what they're doing is basically reselling, you know, other people's stuff. And now, you know, you have Nike where they have some of their own outlets. Under Armour's having their own outlets, just examples. But I mean, you know, when you look at the statistics and you look at the square footage and stuff, I think, you know, we have more malls per square footage, like twice more than the next country.
They keep building them.
And they keep building. Yeah. So, I mean, we're going to have to see a lot of closures, I think, and you'll see that pretty soon. But these latest numbers were not just a seasonal thing to me, especially with department stores. And some of them did report good numbers and had the inventory and had their levels right with weather and stuff like that. It's been a little crazy past 6 months. I get it. But the fact that these guys were just warning of how terrible the environment is, worst numbers since the credit crisis, you know, it just, for me, it doesn't feel like the market should be trading at these levels. When I'm seeing
it's
things
so
like that,
odd. Yeah, so odd.
And the Fed's not working, and you're seeing, you know, earnings declining year over year. I mean, they're getting crushed. And earnings drive prices. That's what happened when the Fed first implemented its policies. We saw earnings go much, much higher. And now we talked about that offline the other day, Andrew, where, a massive decline in earnings doesn't support a market that's just trading 3% off its highs.
Well, let's talk about that. First of all, before I want to make sure we talk about the earnings issue. Christina Bentz, what's her nickname?
Talented Blonde.
Talented Blonde. And she covers retail. I've had her on the show a number of years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. I've had her on. What areas was she saying is actually something that she finds to be good?
Well, that's what she was saying. I mean, she said even a couple luxury places.
Well, like Tiffany's or
no, but they were getting crushed as well. Right. But she wasn't too optimistic, to be honest with you.
Really?
She
she's pretty optimistic things, usually.
Usually, but she wasn't giving me a lot of things. I mean, Terry Lundgren, and she went to that, his conference. He said, Macy's, he really didn't say anything positive. This is a couple weeks ago. I mean, but she wasn't really high on things other than service-oriented businesses where people are going there for the experience and they love that and that's what they're spending. But, she wasn't really too optimistic on a lot of things. And that's a person that usually is optimistic on a lot of stocks.
Interesting. Interesting. Let's talk about earnings for a second here. One of the things that we've talked about is the continual downgrading of estimates for the S&P 500. So back in March of 2015, the estimates for earnings for the S&P 500 for fiscal year 2016 was $135 per share. If you take the entirety of the S&P 500 stocks and you count up and add up all the amount per share earnings that they're going to make, it was $135 estimation. That was March 2015. The last read I've seen from S&P was that it was about $115. Now, sometimes analysts go a little bit too far in either direction. But what is that telling us? I mean, the fact that we've seen this major reduction, markets really haven't come off of those levels. I mean, we're talking about a 20% reduction approximately, right? 20% would be 26. It's about almost 20. So 18%, 17% reduction from where they were a year ago on the outlook. And those still can come down depending on what happens with oil, what happens with a variety of things over the next year. And the question is, what does that tell us about the valuation and the multiples of where we are in the S&P?
It's scary, Andrew, to me. I mean, this is the first time people that know me have followed me for years. I've been in this market for over 20 years and analyzing stocks. I'm usually never the one to say, I'm always voice of reason and fight. And there are some positives out there, but you're seeing just a lot of things fall. Just the consumer spending, the numbers that just recently, it's not just that. You can't really take one factor and say this is going to happen. But the fact where you're seeing earnings come down and the Fed's actually looking to raise rates.
I don't understand that.
They raise rates, and this is much different than I thought 6 months ago, because I'm like, they should have raised them. They should have raised them.
Right.
They can't raise them. It's going to accelerate a deflationary spiral that will really push this market down more than 20%. And hopefully I'm 100% wrong, and a year from now, you can get that call and say, Frank, you were wrong and the market's high. I hope I'm wrong. People own stocks. I want you to make money. But right now, what they're doing, the Fed's looking at the stock market on a day-to-day basis.
They probably got tickers all over the place watching.
It's never happened, and you're going to have these risks, but it's pretty crazy out there. I mean, you're seeing, you're looking at commodities still down. Yes, they came up, but oil's still down 50% off its highs from over 100 not long ago. So, and below
but we have inflation ticking higher. We had one of the highest inflation numbers that we've seen in a while, 0.4% on a month-over-month basis, which is annualized at 4.8. But the real number was 2.1% year over year. So we're above their particular level in terms of their target. We see the unemployment rate of approximately 5%, still adding 200,000 per month of new employees onto the payrolls. And unfortunately, they've trapped themselves because those are the things they're looking at. And they've said, well, don't look at the dots anymore. And they're concerned about markets and all that. But meanwhile, the last several speakers out, even the dubs, over the last week have been talking about how, wage growth is really above our particular level that we wanted to. I mean, if in fact, right now, let's look at it this way. If, in fact, the estimate's 115, and we just do a quick calculation, and the outward PE of 16.5, 17, and we look at about approximately 1,900, let's just say, on the S&P 500 is the target level, mm-hmm. and we're trading at 20, 30, 20, 40, whatever the exact number is, and it is overvalued, and they come in with a rate hike, and then it normalizes it back to, let's say, 10% down from where we are here, so back to 1,850, let's say. Is that the worst thing in the world? Or are we so concerned talking about this that if the Fed does this, it's going to mess with the markets, but it's just going to cool down the current pace of the economy, which may be bad also, but it is going to bring things back to where they should be in terms of the levels of inflation and cool that off. And in terms of that, and then, but let me just add one point, you know, raising the dollar or raising the rate is what really just whacked global markets last year. The thought of raising rates.
I mean, how crazy. I mean, we're talking about negative rates. We're talking about negative rates in Europe, negative rates in Japan. Every time the IMF comes out with a forecast and you hear all these things, you know, wage growth is good from other people and, you know, the unemployment's low. These guys keep lowering GDP estimates as it goes. So for me, I wouldn't be surprised if we go into recession in the U.S. this year. Now, recession is a scary word because last time we had it, you know, the market, financial system almost collapsed. I'm not talking about that. It's a normal course of market. I think we had like 37 or 38 since 1850.
Well, I think that everybody's so concerned about, you know, the word recession and that it's going to be like 2008 that they're so panicked over that they're doing everything they can to try to stave that off versus going through a normal market cycle.
Yeah, and it's a normal market. You know what? And bear markets are great for investors that are prepared because you can buy assets dirt cheap. You're in some of the stocks that, like, for example, even like for retirement portfolios, you know, people want Apple, which I think you need a growth catalyst. Like AT&T, I love because they have a growth catalyst. It took over DirecTV. They went from growing, you know, earnings and sales to basically 1% to now nearly double digits, and it pays a 5% yield. So now you have an income, a value play with a growth component, which is very important. And if you invest in some of those stocks, yeah, if the market comes down, they're going to come down a little bit. But not as much. But also, if you do have cash on the sidelines or you're being smart, you have stops, right? I mean, we're just making predictions. We don't have a crystal ball. The market could double from here. Who knows? But if you have stops in place and you're getting stopped out, say, at 10% from these levels, and the market comes down 20%, you know, you're going to be pretty happy when your favorite stocks are down 15, 20, 25% that you could buy them. So, if you have that mindset going in where the market's going to come down, we're going to have a recession, you will make a ton of money. Just like in 2008, 2009, if you were on the sidelines and you came back into the market, I mean, you're up easily, doubled your 401k right. If you're fully invested, well, no matter what you've bought.
But what's interesting is that I think there's a fear of being out of the market right now because each and every time we see a drop, it is so quick to turn around to the upside, so quick that people, it's almost impossible to figure out when should I get in because you get a couple of false starts here and there. And yes, you can use your technicals and clearly there are some good lines. But I think people in general just don't want to be out because they're like, listen, you know what? I was spooked out of the market in 2008. I got back in 2011. Look at all the money I left on the table. Or they said, hey, you know what? I didn't get out back then. How much worse can it get? How much worse can it get than what happened in 2008, 2009? And you know what? Look where I am today. I'm above where I would have been, you know, where I was, even from the high there, because we reached all-time highs not too long ago. So I don't think people are really in tune with that whole idea. And that's why I think there's so much staying power with the markets. It seems, unless it's just all algos that are just holding stuff up just to hold things up, because the markets have been incredibly resilient. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, they have been incredibly. Considering that earnings are declining, and like I said before, when you see leverage come out of the market, which is a deflationary trend, people are lowering their debt. And, you know, we're all told that that's a great thing. Actually, for the markets, it's a bad thing. It's a sign of deflationary. It's a deflationary signal. And we're looking at the Fed looking to raise rates. We're looking at what's the growth engine of the world? Asia, China, doing terrible, right? So, you know, you saw that with Apple numbers. You look at some of these corporations saying how bad China was. You know, when you see all these factors and just factor in, now you're seeing these retail results come out. You're seeing Apple miss. You're seeing Priceline miss. It suggests that the market should be down a lot more than it is. Now, does that mean, well, we have 0% interest rates. There's nowhere else to put your money? Yeah, maybe. But that was a good case at 13, 14 times earnings. At 17, 18 times earnings, I mean, do you really want to own McDonald's at 130? Do you want to own Nike at 60, trading at its historical, you know, 17-year high valuation? No, you got to be careful where there's a lot of good components, a lot of good areas to invest in, but you have to be very, very careful because right now it does not suggest that the market should be trading at this level. And one of the biggest indicators, guys, since the history of the markets is earnings drive stock prices, and earnings are declining for the first time year over year since the credit crisis. And that's what has me worried.
Well, let's talk about gold then. Gold has had some legs. We talked about a moment ago that you have had some of the miners that you liked and all that. But, you know, there was a great piece written by a gent I had on not too long ago from Salient. I don't know if you read his work, Epsilon Theory. And what he talked about in this most recent discussion was brilliant. It was about, like, let's look at what's driving things. He looked at it and he kind of came up with this, the end of the discussion conclusion that it was all about the trade-weighted dollar. And if you look at the correlation between commodity prices, emerging markets, U.S. stocks, you look at everything and look at the trade-weighted dollar, which the Fed has some control over because they can kind of, you know, push that up or down with commentary, et cetera. It's all related to the trade-weighted dollar. And what really reflated recently was the move down on the trade-weighted dollar. And that obviously reflated all these companies, which we both agree that a lot of the move that was made was on Freeport and U.S. Steel and various steel companies. And I mean, it was a lot due to the fact that there was a reflation trade going on or the dollar going lower. But gold last week had a pretty rough time after the Fed came out with their commentary, which was a bit more hawkish, down, 2%.
Like a 3-week low, yeah.
You know, and so does gold have more legs, or is this kind of like, okay, well, that was that because it was a more of an anticipation of this lower dollar, and as the dollar goes up, this is, you know, all bets are off?
It's interesting, right? I mean, it's definitely in trend with the dollar, right? Dollar's been coming down. You're seeing commodity prices and gold, silver go higher. But, I mean, gold has just gotten crushed so bad. And I think, yeah, I don't know if I see the dollar going much higher from these levels. But even if gold stays the same, I think that you're still seeing incredible discounts where, I mean, MUX, I think, was a $10 stock, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so we bought at 95. We're still in it at 250.
95 cents.
I'm sorry, 95 cents we bought. Yeah, I'm thinking of Yamana Gold because that was another one. It was trading $1.50 like it was going to go out of business. We bought $1.60 and it's like $4 or $5 today. So, I mean, and Yamana Gold was a $20 stock. So you see these massive moves, but you see where these guys could go if gold goes high. Remember, they've been cutting costs for 4 straight years. It's been one of the worst markets, even worse than the credit crisis for the miners. And this is an area I went to a ton of conferences over the last 9 months. Met with a lot of smart people, brilliant people, been in this industry for over 30 years. But I think for gold, I think if you want to play that stock price, the gold price, the commodity, you know, I think it definitely has some upside here. Not a ton of upside. I think the stocks still have tremendous upside. Yeah. And you're seeing the 100%, 200% returns on some of these stocks, right? And how much did gold move off the bottom?
Oh, yeah, no. They're definitely much more leveraged to the price of gold, just like the oil stocks were, for that matter.
Yeah, and I'll tell you one thing here. If you're going to buy, especially the junior miners, because some of these guys are good, but if you go in there, like 95% of these people all BS, they'll tell you these great stories. I have a mine right next to, you know, whatever, Goldcorp's biggest mine. You know, they don't tell you that it's going to cost them $2 billion to drill. Like, they leave that out. And they have a $200 million market cap. But what you want to look for, and this is very important, even if you write these downs, is you want to have an experienced management team, someone who's been through the ups and downs. Every one junior miner stock, for every 3,000 of them, only one brings an actual development site to production. So if you have a guy that's running your company that's done that, that knows the cost associated with it, that's a huge step. You want to make sure they're fully funded, because if they need cash, they're going to dilute the hell out of the stock. They're probably going to issue warrants. A lot of these companies that I'm investing in, they don't need to raise money. You're looking at insiders. Make sure they have stake in the game. I mean, I called out a guy at a conference, and I knew the guy who was running the conference, and he kind of yelled at me, but the guy's like, our stock's going to triple. It was like 3 years ago. Our stock's going to triple. So I'm on my phone. I'm looking. I'm like, you know, how much do you guys own? He's like, well, we own, you know, less than 0.5%. I said, well, if I thought my stock was going to triple, I'd probably own like 60%. Right. You know, yeah, and everybody's right. Like, look at it. I was like, really? Come on. If you're going to tell me the stock's going to triple and you don't own it, make sure they have stake in the game, right? Because their interests are aligned with yours. Also, infrastructure is huge, because right now the companies I've invested in, Andrew, they've been buying projects where $50, $60, $70 million has been spent to drill in these properties, and they're getting them for like $3, $4 million, which is incredible. So that's important. Also, mine-friendly districts. You don't want to invest in Venezuela where, you know, Chavez could say, okay, you know what? That mine's mine.
But yeah, well, yeah, the government.
So just a lot of things you got to look for in this. I still think there's tremendous upside in a lot of these stocks, but we may see a pullback first.
Let me ask you something now. There's something that happened this week, and I was kind of interested in this from the aspect of not just the stock, but the whole flavor of the market. And it was Tesla. So what happened was that on the morning of, I think it was Wednesday morning of last week, Tesla was upgraded by Goldman. Goldman puts an upgrade on a company like a Tesla, especially with all the things going on. That's, hey, thumbs up, right?
Absolutely.
Yep. In the afternoon, after the close, that day, Tesla comes out with a $2 billion offering underwritten by Goldman. It seems to me, and that's a tremendous amount of dilution, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, whether the stock goes up or down from there, I'm just... What's with the conflict?
I didn't know that was underwritten by Goldman.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know if Tesla used Goldman at the upgrade to push the stock up. This way they can get a higher price and raise more money at a higher price.
I pretty. I
But Andrew, you didn't know that investment firms, you know, they're even in Goldman Sachs, like they're they don't know what they're doing. It's totally different. So their research arm for investment banking is totally different.
That's what I was going to ask you. So you think the research department didn't put out something like, is anybody working on something that we should know about before we put this out? Yeah, seriously, do you think that? Or the underwriting department says, hey, you know what? There needs to be a halt to any news on this because we're doing an underwriting on this and a secondary? You don't think that there's some kind of compliance? Or let me ask you, if you don't think there is, don't you think there should be?
Look, guys, you can use your common sense and answer that yourselves.
Yeah, we know. We know there's something not so kosher is the point.
But I can tell you one thing. I mean, I respect Goldman. Everybody hates them. They usually have the smartest guys in the room. They have the most money at their firm, biggest investment firm. But you look at Goldman over the past like few months, and it's been, I don't know if they're tied so much for the hedge fund industry where the performance has been really bad. I'm not picking on these guys because we all go through this, even you and I, Andrew, where sometimes things don't work and you have bad streaks and you pick losers. But, I mean, Goldman is saying oil is going to 20. Now it's 50. And they just said, all right, oil is going to go higher.
Going back up.
They said you should sell all your stocks for the past few months. So not sell all your stocks, but basically like
reduce exposure,
which has been wrong. I mean, sell all gold, right, for the past year.
Forever.
Over that,
gold,
you know,
forever, and, yeah.
I mean, they've been right on that call for a while, though. I got to give them credit. But lately, they've been 100%. I mean, the gold stocks are tremendously higher. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if Goldman's the type of person I listen to. But getting back to your question with Tesla, it's kind of it's interesting how, you know, Goldman comes out. They recommend the stock goes high. Now they're able to raise more money, which is going to definitely be more fees to Goldman because the stock goes higher.
Right.
But why would you recommend the stock immediately? And then you know that, you know, usually when you're going to raise money, you're going to dilute your stock, right? You're going to issue more shares. That's what you're doing. And why would you upgrade the stock when you're participating in that offering? You know, I don't know. It's just something kind of weird to me.
Yeah. But. And meanwhile, after the offering, the stock did drop down pretty well when the announcement came out, but then it popped up as down maybe, I don't know, 1% that day that it was trading. But what's interesting about that is, you know, there are some of those stocks that are just resilient, you know, where we know that they're going to be using this money. The intent is to use this money to fund the factories for the production of the new Cheapy, the new car they have that's coming out, which they have all sorts of orders for. And, you know, that maybe is going to be like, oh, well, that's okay. But a $2 billion offering, that's a pretty substantial amount of dilution of a stock.
It is. And more important, really, if you doubt this and you're like, oh, there's conspiracy theories and stuff like that, I want you to think about if you're the CEO of a public company, right? Say if you're Elon Musk and you're Tesla. You're going to raise money, right?
Yeah.
So when you raise money, you have to go to these brokerage firms, right? Because they're going to raise the money for you. You got to give them fees. Would you go to the guy who has a sell rating on your stock, or would you go to the guy who has a buy rating on you? So if Goldman Sachs had a sell rating on Tesla, do you really think that Elon Musk would say, okay, let me use these, we're going to give Goldman Sachs a ton of fees? Would you do that?
Well, why'd you do it?
I wouldn't do it.
Why'd you do
so
it?
So the fact that Goldman has the buy rating on them, I think basically probably got them access to the $2 billion that they were going to raise, which they're going to collect fees on. And you know, it's not out of line to say that. I think that's common. I'm a common sense guy.
Yeah, but the buy went on that morning. You have to put the buy before, whether it was a neutral or a sell prior, the buy rating or the conviction list, whatever it was, the upgrade, I guess we can call it, went on that morning.
Yeah, before the capital raise.
Yeah, but they didn't just that afternoon say, hey, by the way, we want to do $2 billion, let it out this afternoon. They got to do a little bit of work to get the capital raise going.
Of course, that's what I'm saying. So they probably went through, and I'm sure Goldman was like, okay, we'll upgrade the stock. I just don't see,
so
you know.
Let's say it a different way.
Okay.
That Elon Musk bought the buy rating from Goldman.
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay, just making sure we're on the same page.
And before you go and yell at Elon Musk.
I'm not yelling at him. I'm just saying the facts.
You know, before you say that, is that a smart move for his company?
Of course.
Absolutely.
Of course.
And is it legal? Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I'm just making sure just that everybody understands how this all works.
How this works, exactly.
You know, it's like anything else. If you know how it works, let's put it this way. If you play a game, if you're playing, I don't care what game it is, you're playing Monopoly, you're playing Scrabble, I don't care what game you're playing, and it's rigged somehow. You know that you're playing Scrabble and somebody, however they did it, they figured out how to mark the S's and the X's and the J's and the Z's so they could, and they pull that up into their hand and that's rigged in their favor, right? If you don't know it, you're screwed. If you do know it, well, maybe then you'll figure out ways around it in that your letters that will match and you can possibly beat the game as well, or at least keep pace. But that you just got to know what the game is. At least know what the game is. So I'm saying.
The game is, yeah. And you know, I don't know if you still have time or if you want to go back. I forgot you asked me three different sectors that we were talking about. We touched oil. I don't know if we touched oil yet, but I don't know if we had time for that.
A couple of minutes. Yeah. Let's go. Talk.
No, for oil stocks, they've obviously bounced back. Even Chesapeake, I'm surprised that the bondholders accepted that deal. They really screwed the bondholders.
Well, that whole deal was a weird deal with his death and stuff, and just all the whole
thing. Even before that, though, even before his death. I mean, the whole restructure, I mean, the bond, they basically really screwed over the bondholders, or they wouldn't have been in even bigger trouble. But yeah, you have to keep in mind, there's huge short positions on these stocks. I think a lot of this is short covering. Goldman just came out and said, oh, well, we got a lot of oil off the market. Guys, there's tons of oil on the market. And you have to remember one thing, that the average price for shale producers is $55. Some of them, maybe Pioneer, EOG Resources, can produce at $50 a barrel. We're still below that today. So these guys, their stock prices are going up. And just to give you a figure, if you're looking at their cash flow when oil prices were averaged over 90 for like, what was it, 2012, 13, 14? Before the prices came down. These guys in 2015, I think it was, they were using 80% of their cash flow to service their debt, right?
Yeah.
So think about that. Now, and that was when prices were over 90, and then they started coming down. Now look how much is going towards debt.
Yeah, it's like 90%.
And if prices go up to 55, 60, you may see the U.S. produce over 10 million barrels of oil. Production levels are down just like 5-7% right now. You're seeing things in Nigeria. You're seeing different, it's going to affect
Canada. You're seeing rig closures every week with the Baker Hughes rig count.
And Andrew, we're talking shale producers here.
Right.
The majors need 65 and higher. They only have 8% of their total resources are in shale, right? They totally miss a shale revolution. So their deep water, their oil sands, their costs are much, much higher. And you're still under that price. So if you think like, wow, oil companies, yeah, they bounce off the low. But be very, very careful, because we're going to see a flood of oil on the market. It's going to continue to see that. And when, I just don't see prices. If they go higher to 55, 60, these guys are in so much debt, especially U.S. shale producers. They're going to produce. I mean, they can get these things back up within a week or two. So much oil on the market to pay off their debt. That's why they don't have to avoid this, that you could see another downturn in oil prices. I wouldn't be surprised if they hit like $30, $32 again.
Interesting. All right, so and we talk about technology. Obviously, a lot of things happening in that whole realm of things. We'll see how Apple shakes out, of course. China, we haven't even touched about China. You know, the continuation of the slowdown there. Japan just...
China's fine now. Tim Cook said so.
Oh, yes, that's a good point. Tim Cook said so. Yeah, speaking about buying a rating, Tim Cook said so on The Cramer Show on two episodes.
Yeah, that they're fine. I think they declined like 27%. Now, by the way, you know what I love about it? You know who's the best guy in the world? Carl Icahn. People on my podcast are probably like, Frank, don't do this again. But Carl Icahn's a guy that sat down with him, drank some brandy, expensive wine, whatever it was, hang out, cigars, and said, listen, this is what you have to do with your cash. You need to buy back the stock. It's going, and he's telling everybody, Icahn's on TV, right? This is like 3-4 months ago that it's going to 170, 180. It's a $1 trillion valuation company.
No, this is two years ago, not 2 years ago.
No. But this isn't even that long ago when he was doing this. No.
When Icahn sat down with Tim Cook?
When Icahn sat down with Tim Cook and got that was a little bit longer. But if you're looking, when he's saying Apple's worth a lot more, go back like 4 or 5 months. And then what happens, he gets Tim Cook, right? This is why Steve Jobs never talked to anybody. But he gets them to almost initiate like even a bigger buyback, use that cash, and then he gets out of the stock and tells everybody, of course, after he's out of it, probably got out like 105, 110. But it's kind of amazing that he's able to convince a company like Apple to here's the strategy you should do. They do it, and he actually get out of the stock.
And he makes up on it. And he's actually, the last I heard was Icahn was 150% net short the U.S. markets. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear that yet.
I heard that Soros is out of the markets. He likes many of the gold companies. He's loading up on that, but he's out of the market. You got Drunken Miller out there also. It's interesting. Some of the brightest guys, some of the brightest guys the last few years got burned pretty well, right? But some of the brightest guys are so negative right now. It's really kind of fascinating. Even David Tepper is not like really, he's pretty neutral, I would say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's one of the risks of the thesis, right? Because in the credit crisis, nobody knew what a CDO was, right? Until it was too late. Nobody knew what was going on behind the scenes and they're packaging these products because everybody wanted higher interest. I don't know if they paid the S&P and Moody's to put AAA rating, whatever it was. But nobody knew what was going on behind the scenes, where today everybody knows how much debt we have. Everybody's calling for this crash. I mean, you never really see a crash that everybody expects, right? I mean, that rarely happens.
Right.
Well, so, even 1987, even the technology crash, people were kind of calling for it. No one knew it was going to decline with a 5,000 to 1,000, whatever it did, the NASDAQ. But that's one of the risks where so many people are predicting it. But just for me, the fact that earnings are not growing right now should not suggest that the stock.
Well, and then also the other thing was, I think nobody really predicted the whole oil move. I mean, that was pretty, I mean, yeah, there were people that predicted it, but that was pretty rough. That was a really ugly move.
Yeah, no. And to be fair, you know, for me, when oil prices started coming down, this is what you talk about the conference. I asked everyone to raise their hand. This was like in October at a Stansbury conference that they invited me to. And I said, how many of you own oil stocks in your portfolio? And like 97% of the audience raised their hand. Right. I said, you should sell every stock because oil prices already came down. But these guys, their hedges were about to come off. And once their hedges came off, they were dead. And I knew the earnings were going to crash. So it's, yeah, I didn't think oil prices would go down to where they were. I think they probably should be trading around 37, 40, 42, around that area would be fair. So we're a little bit on the high end right now, but I didn't think they would go as low as they did. I mean, fall under 30. That was pretty crazy.
Well, and then you have all the people. You got the opposite thing going on, all the shorts that were out there that had a cover and then the move up. I mean, listen, even with much of the numbers that came out this week, where API on Tuesday night came out with a number that was actually a drawdown, and that kind of goosed it up a little bit. But then on Wednesday, we saw that there was actually a much larger build than anticipated. Production was still down. Gasoline inventories were drawdown. But still, oil was very resilient in that. Until, by the way, back to the thesis of my guy from Epsilon Theory, who talked about the trade-weighted dollar discussion, right? So you had a drawdown. You had a build on oil. Meanwhile, oil keeps on piling higher after that. First, it comes down. Then it goes right at the 10:30. Mm-hmm. In the afternoon at 2 o'clock, when the Fed comes out with their commentary, which was hawkish, and you saw that the dollar really gained, what happened? Oil just rolled right over. Right over. So what was holding up oil? It was the weaker dollar. It was the thought that the Fed was going to be dovish and all that. So, I mean, I think everybody would be really smart to keep a watch on the not only the dollar, the trade weighted, if you can find that index somewhere. I don't know if it's readily available, just out in the open. Bloomberg has it. A few others have it. But look for the trade weighted dollar index. And as that moves, the correlation is, I think they're like, 0.8. or 0.9 or so for many of the various commodities, markets, et cetera, around the world. So pretty interesting. Anyway, Frank Curzio, I want to tell you, thank you so much for joining me today. Of course, you can listen each and every, well, multiple times through the week to Wall Street Unplugged. And he has
second best podcast.
Yeah, Yeah, that's exactly right. So when I'm on your podcast, I'll tell you too, you're the best. I'll be on soon. I get on there quite often. We talk about a variety of topics like this. I know that my listeners always enjoy the discussions with you. Again, happy belated birthday. And thanks, we'll get this up and we'll make sure that people get the information they need specifically on some of the topics we talked about. So thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on, bud.
Well, you're welcome. Hey, thanks again for joining me today. All of our listeners, you can check out all the information on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The show notes for this episode, plus other things you want to listen to going back. If you want to listen to some of the past episodes that Frank was on, just do a quick search at the top of The Disciplined Investor, Frank Curzio, and you'll find all the different episodes that he was on and check out what he's talking about. But otherwise, I hope you have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week with another great lineup of topics. And if you want to ask me anything, maybe you have it on the show, send your questions to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.